So, legacy of the Maccabees, should courage be encouraged? So the starting point is trying to define what courage is, and this is not a very simple task. There's a book called The Psychology of Courage, Modern Research on an Ancient Virtue, and many of the chapters in that book are there to provide what they think is the definition of courage, but there's a lot of debate. So there's really, it's hard to exactly define and measure what courage is. There's a more popular psychological book called The Courage Quotient, How Science Can Make You Braver. It's by Dr. Robert Biswas Diener. So he defines courage as follows. He says, courage is the willingness to act toward a moral or worthwhile goal despite the presence of risk, uncertainty, and fear. So there's really four components according to his definition. Number one is that it has to be moral and worthwhile. So if I, you know, am afraid to go drag racing down Nostrand Avenue, but I decide to do it anyway, that's not courage because there's really no moral or worthwhile. Perhaps it's even a bad thing to do. It is a bad thing to do. So that would not be courageous according to his definition. A risk, uncertainty, yeah, there has to be some element of not knowing what's going to happen. The outcome isn't clear, and you still decide to do the action anyway. And then fear. So this is actually debated, whether or not courage is overcoming fear to make it that there's still fear but I'm overcoming it, or do you get to a point where there's actually no fear at all? So that's a philosophical debate. He argues that there is fear and you're overcoming that fear and still acting, but there can still be fear. You can still be afraid to do it, but you do it anyway. So again, moral, there's some sort of risk, uncertainty, and fear. Daniel Putman, who wrote the first chapter of the first book that I quoted, Psychology of Courage, he actually breaks courage into three distinct categories. So courage can be found in the area of physical courage, so that's overcoming a fear of death or physical harm for the sake of a noble goal such as defense of your country or your family. So that's number one, physical courage. But then there's also something that he calls moral courage. And that's overcoming fear of social ostracism or rejection in order to maintain ethical integrity. There's no real physical harm that is being threatened. It's more of a moral. You have to decide to do the right thing despite the fact that there might be some sort of harm to you. And then finally, he argues that there's a concept called psychological courage. This is a more modern type of idea, but he argues that it's overcoming the fear of losing the psyche, the fear of psychological death. So for example, he says, the courage of an addict to overcome his or her addiction, or the person abused as a child overcoming deep psychological fears to become a loving and productive adult. So that's what he calls psychological courage. There could obviously be an overlap between these three categories. Someone like Martin Luther King, who has moral courage, who is standing up for an ideal, was also putting himself in physical harm. So that's physical and moral courage, and you could have an overlap between all three of them. Courage is a very important value. Samuel Johnson wrote that courage is reckoned, as a quote, courage is reckoned the greatest of all virtues because unless a man has that virtue, he has no security for preserving any others. Winston Churchill commented similarly that courage is the first of human qualities because it guarantees all others. C.S. Lewis, you cannot practice any of the other virtues very long without bringing this one into play. So you need courage in order to act out on any other virtue or value that you want to address, that you want to bring forth, because you need the courage to actually go forth with it. So these three quotes that I just quoted come from an article actually by Rabbi Yitzchak Blau. And this article appeared in Tradition a few years ago, and the title is Courage a Jewish Value? And I recommend that you read this article. You can access it online for free if you just search. If you want to look more into the philosophical aspects of courage, in the secular sources, he quotes Plato, the Stoics, Thomas Aquinas, amongst others, and how the Jewish sources compare to that. But that's not what we are going to do today. We're going to, some of the sources that we're going to quote, he mentions, but we're going to sort of take it from a different aspect. We're not going to focus that much on comparing it philosophically. So the way that I want to break down the shiur in order to adapt to the two-part format that we have become accustomed to in the Lunch and Learn is that we'll first look into the moral and psychological courage in the Jewish sources and give some practical advice from the psychological literature on how to increase, how to boost our courage. And then during the second half of the shiur, after we eat, we will look into the more controversial subject of physical courage, military courage, in the Jewish sources, tracing its way from Tanakh all the way to the modern day state of Israel and determine whether this type of courage should be encouraged. So for part one, this is where your sources begin. We'll begin in the Chumash, source number one. Chumash says, again, this is moral and psychological courage, Lo sakiru panim ba mishpat, kakaton kagadol tishma'un. So this is addressing a judge, that you shall not respect persons in judgment, you shouldn't favor anybody, you shall hear the small and the great alike. And the important line, Lo saguru mipnei ish, do not be afraid in the face of any man. What does this mean, do not be afraid? So the Gemara expounds on this idea in source number two. Rabbi Yeshua ben Korcha Omer, Minayim l'talmid sheyoshev lifnei rabbo. You have a student who is sitting in front of his master, his Rebbe, who is judging a case. V'raz chus la'ani v'cho v'la'ashir. And the student sees that there is an argument that could be made for the person who is in the judgment. There's a rich person and a poor person. There's an argument the student believes to be made for the poor person. So minayin shelo yishtov, how do you know that he shouldn't be silent, that he should speak up? Shenemar lo saguru mipnei ish, do not be afraid in the face of any man. And Rashi explains that this student needs to overcome his reverence that he has for his teacher and speak up. The Torah Tamima adds here that what are we dealing here with, a poor person and a rich person? Because he doesn't only have to stand up to his Rebbe, he also has to stand up to the nobility, to the people who have power, the people with the wealth. So he has to overcome his fear of his Rebbe and the fear of the wealthy in order to speak up. It takes courage for someone who is not in a position of power to speak out to that power. This is moral courage from the Chumash. If you see in the next source, number three, Amar Abaye, Hait Surba Mirabanam Derachamin Le B'nei Masa. So if you have a scholar, a rabbi, who the people in the town, they love him. So he says, Lav Mishum Dema'ali Tfe. It's not because he's a great rabbi, but rather, Ela Mishum Delo Muchach Lehu B'milei D'Shemayim. Because he does not rebuke them for neglecting spiritual matters. So I'm not going to ask you if you like me or not. But the Gemara Abaye is saying is that if there is a rabbi who is so beloved, chances are it's because he's not rebuking enough. So again, whether or not this is practical or not, the point is that it takes some courage for someone to speak up against people who look up to him, not just in the position of, you know, who has the powers. It's a person who is, in the first case, it was the student speaking up to the Rebbe. Here it's the Rebbe. Does he have courage to speak to the students, to speak to the community? So it takes courage to stand up for what you believe in, to stand up for your moral convictions. And there are a number of stories in the Gemara that bring out this idea of having courage to stick up for your convictions despite negative consequences or the possibility of negative consequences. One of them is a story about Akavya ben Mahalal, who we learn in the fifth chapter of Adios, Mishnayos, that he held true to his religious opinions despite the fact that his colleagues, who were the majority, disagreed with him. And they pressured him to change his opinions, but he did not. He stood up for what he believed in. And according to one opinion in the Gemara, this didn't turn out, this wasn't a happy ending. According to one opinion in the Gemara, he was excommunicated and he actually died. The other opinion said it didn't go that far, but the point is that he was able to stand up for what he believed in despite the fact that there was pressure from other rabbis for him to conform to their opinions. So it takes courage to stand up for what is moral and what is right. And then finally, for part number one, in the fourth source, in terms of psychological courage, so again, I mentioned before that this psychological courage seems to be more of a modern idea, but perhaps some of it is alluded to in the famous Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. The Mishnah says, Ezehu Gibor, who is mighty, strength, Hakovesh es Yitzro, who subdues his Yetzer. So how do you understand Yetzer? So this is a big debate. It could be a lunch and learn topic onto its own. What is the Yetzer Hara? But if you don't just say that the Yetzer Hara is a temptation to do X or Y, if the Yetzer is sort of your inclinations of who you are, of what you grew up with, sort of a psychological explanation of what the Yetzer Hara is, whether it's good or bad, you know, we could debate, but that Yetzer, how do you overcome that Yetzer, those psychological issues that we have to deal with? That's the Gibor. Ezu Gibor HaKovesh Etz Yetzer. You have to confront that. And he actually quotes an interesting pasuk, which will transition us into part two. Tov erech apayim mi gibor, u moshe beruach mi loched ir. that it is better for someone who is slow to anger, that is more gibor, that's more might, than one who takes a city. Right? This psychological or moral courage to actually overcome your fears, to overcome what you are weak at, that is takes more courage, takes more strength than actual military or physical courage, according to Shlomo HaMelech in Mishle. That pasuk comes from Mishle. So just to sum up part one, as the food gets ready to come out, is that there is this concept of moral courage, and courage is important. It takes courage to stand up to people who are in power over us, and it takes courage to stand up, even if we are in power, to say what we believe in out of and not fear what other people will think of us. So there is this idea of courage. It traces its way back into the Chumash and throughout the Gemara. And then in the next part of the Shir, in part two, looks like we have a little bit of time. So let's actually go to source number five for a second. Before we get to part two, source number five. How do we work on increasing this courage? Right, so this could have been done now or it could have been done later. We'll do it now. How do we work on increasing courage? If we're going to assume that there is a value to being courageous, so let's say I'm just not courageous. Is it possible to work on that courage? So in the book that I quoted to you before, The Courage Quotient, by Dr. Robert Biswas-Diener, so the courage quotient is what he believes is that equation at the bottom of that box. The courage quotient equals the willingness to act over fear. That basically there's two ways to increase your courage. There's one way is to deflate the fear. That's the first oval over there. And the other way is to increase the ability or the willingness to act. You decrease the fear, and this way it's not as hard for you to do, or you increase the willingness to act. And these are actually two separate things. So let's try to give examples of how to work on this. What does it mean to decrease the fear, and what does it mean to increase the capability to act? So how do we decrease fear? So three examples, three possibilities that he suggests. He says number one is to remove uncertainty by gathering information. So meaning the more you know about it, like we said, part of the fear is because of the unknown. So if there's uncertainty, so you need the courage to overcome that. So if you decrease the uncertainty by doing your research, let's say you're afraid of some medical procedure because of the unknown of what's going to happen. So that it makes sense to be afraid, but the more research that we know about it, the more you look up on the issue, so hopefully the more you know about it will decrease the amount of fear that you have. Another way to do it is exposing yourself to anxiety-provoking situations. This is somewhat more controversial. There's something called exposure therapy in psychology. I just saw a video about it in class. That let's say somebody's afraid of snakes. So how do you deal with snakes? How do you deal with that fear? So the way that this professor argues is that you, in a safe environment, you expose that person right there to a real live snake. And over time, it can take a few hours. Some people do it over the course of a week. But this person did it in the course of a few hours. Slowly, you show them the snake. And then eventually, by the end, they're actually holding the snake. So originally this person was terribly mortified of snakes and was literally screaming and crying and was afraid the snake was going to kill her. And by the end, she was actually holding the snake. So the exposure to the fear can help you overcome the fear. I wouldn't try that at home. That is something that should be done in a safe environment, in an office or something. But exposing yourself to a fear can help you overcome that fear. So that's number one, removing the uncertainty and exposing yourself to the fear. Another way of doing it is to let go of your egotistic concerns. A lot of times we're afraid of doing something because we're thinking about ourselves. And the more we think about ourselves, the more afraid we are. The more we can transcend our sense of self and not think about us personally, the more capable we are of overcoming that fear. So if you empathize with others or you think about how we belong to a greater whole. We're not just a person, we are a community. We're not just a community, we are Klal Yisrael. Whatever it is, if you don't just focus on yourself, you focus on us as an entire people, then perhaps that can help you decrease the amount of fear. And finally, the third suggestion, he has a few more, but the third that we'll suggest is to manage physiological response. So sometimes we are afraid and our body starts hyperventilating or we start, you know, it's hard to control that. So there are techniques
One of them called progressive muscle relaxation, which you can search on your own if you want, and that's something that you can do whenever you feel afraid, to tense up certain parts of your muscles of your body until they're really, really, you feel the tension, and then you let go, you release. So that is proven in a lot of cases to actually decrease the fear, decrease the tension that you have. That's good in handling stress, and it's good in handling fear. Progressive muscle relaxation. So that's one way of working on courage, to decrease the fear. What about increase the willingness to act? So number one is to realize that a lot of times willingness to act is based on situational factors. So there are roles or responsibilities that we can take on where we can sort of blend into the role. And when we blend into the role, we sort of, again, not think of ourselves, because that the role is made for courage. If whether it's a, you know, not everybody's going to be a good cop or a good firefighter, but someone who is a firefighter is in a role that even if he has a fear, he has to overcome that fear. So he has to, there's a willingness to act because that's his job. To make it a little bit, for those of us who are not firefighters, so personally, to give probably expose a little bit too much about myself, so I tend to be, or at least before I, you know, when I was younger, I'm a shy person. I'm not, you know, I would never walk over to someone in a room and say hello to them. Just, not that I am unfriendly, I'm just shy. But I am a rabbi, or assistant rabbi in a shul, and that's part of the job, is I have to go over and say hello to people. And I'm not, and I do it, because that's, I blend into the role, that's part of the role. So it's, even though there's a natural tendency to be maybe afraid of a social situation or a social experience, so if you put yourself in a role that you can overcome that, because that's part of the role, so that helps increase the willingness to act. Another way of increasing willingness to act is to join a group, a collective bravery. And one of the examples he gives is the flight, I forgot what it is, 603, what was the flight that... when they found out about 9/11, that they 608, right? They grounded. They purposely. We'll finish in a minute. They purposely grounded the plane and crashed into the, because they were a collective group. Even though an individual might be afraid, since they were a group, they were able to overcome and willing and increase the willingness to act. And then finally, the third one before we close for our drinks is that he says, don't be afraid of failure. A lot of people don't want to act because they're afraid of failing. So they just they sit at home and they don't do anything. So if you're afraid of doing something because you might fail, that's not good. Failure is good. Failing helps us grow. So we shouldn't be afraid of failure to do something that we think is morally correct because we might fail. We should stand up. And there are many quotes, we won't go through them now, but there are many quotes that come to this idea, both from the secular literature and from, there are a few in Mishlei as well. So these tips, again, by decreasing fear, increasing the willingness to act, these tips can help for moral and psychological courage. And again, they will be applicable as well if someone needs to increase physical courage for some reason, but that's a topic which we will discuss after we eat.
Stay tuned.
Okay, stay tuned for part two. Okay, so we are ready to move on to part two. So part two, we're going to focus on physical courage. We're going to see how the Torah deals with it and see how this is a somewhat controversial topic and how it's related to the state of Israel today and to Hanukkah that is fast approaching. So we'll start with source number six. Source number six is a pasuk in the Torah. Chizku ve'imsu al tiru v'al ta'artzu mipneim. So the Torah tells us, be strong and of good courage. Fear not. If you have enemies, don't be afraid. There are other sources throughout Tanakh, another four or five times, where this phrase of chizku ve'imsu, to be strong, be courageous, does come up. I'm not going to list all of them now, but just to know that this isn't just a once in the Torah type of thing, this concept of being strong and being courageous does repeat. In verse number 7, you have two psukim from the 20th chapter of Devarim. One is the third pasuk in the chapter, the next is the eighth pasuk in the chapter, dealing with war. So the pasuk says that there was a priest who used to get up before the war and sort of give people encouragement. And he says, V'amar aleihem Shema Yisrael, atem karevim ayom lemelcham al oyvechem, you are approaching a war with your enemies. Al yerach levavchem, al tiru v'al tachbezu v'al tartu mipneyem. Don't, the translation, let not your heart be faint, fear not, nor be alarmed, neither be frightened of them. So here is this idea of being courageous when it comes to physical or the military battle. And then the next source, right after that, in the 8th pasuk, it says that this Kohen, this priest, used to sort of warn people and say, if you can't handle it, go back home. And there are some exemptions that you had from the war, whether or not you just got married or you just built a house. But he also says that Ba'amru, in the middle of that pasuk, Mi'a Yishaya Rei V'rach Haleva, who is it that is fearful and faint-hearted? Yelech V'yashav L'Beso, go back home. Below Yimas Eslavav Achav Kilbabo. And if you're nervous, if you're afraid, that's going to spread. Other people are going to be afraid. So go home, don't be a part of this war. If you look in source number 8, the Rambam has a fascinating understanding of this pasuk. The Rambam says, Mi'a ish hayareh v'rach alevav. What does that mean, who is fearful? Kimashma'o. He says it is exactly what it sounds like, if you are actually fearful. And we'll address what, later on, we'll see exactly what he's addressing when he this comment is really alluding to. But he says, someone who is fearful has to go back. She'ein b'libo koach la'amod b'kishrei ha'malchum. He doesn't have the strength, his heart doesn't have the strength to stand up to the war. U'mi'acha she'ichnas b'kishrei ha'malchama. If you do, if this person does go into the war, yishon al mikveh Yisrael, he should rely on Hashem. U'moshio be'isara, that will save him in the times of distress. V'yeda shal yichud Hashem u'ose mochama, he is fighting because that is what God wants him to do. V'yasim nafsho b'chapo, v'lo yira, v'lo yifakhe, v'lo yakshov, right, he shouldn't be afraid. V'lo yakshov lo be'ishto, he shouldn't be worried about his wife, v'lo be'banav, his children. Ela yimcha zichrona milibo, he should actually forget about them when he's at battle. V'yifne michol davar l'mochama, he should forget about everything else except the war that it's that's in front of him. The Rambam says if you're in war and you become afraid, you are violating a commandment in the Torah. The Torah says, do not be afraid. You are afraid. You are violating the commandment. He goes even further. He says, because you are afraid, are causing everybody else to be afraid, and if we lose the war, it's because you're afraid. He blames this person who's afraid on anybody who dies because of him. And the Rambam continues. The point of the Rambam, it's fascinating, is it's actually a prohibition to be fearful during war. So let's say somebody is afraid, what's he supposed to do? Right, so number one, it's just important to point out, the Rambam's saying there is an out here. The person is warned and says, if you are afraid, go home. This is talking to someone who does not go home, stays in the war, and is afraid. Right? So if you don't have a lot of courage, so there is an app, you could go back home. You do not have to sign up for this war. But once you are going to sign up, now you have to overcome that fear. You no longer can be afraid. There are other opinions on this pasuk. Some don't look at it as a commandment. The Ramban actually says that it's a promise, that if you do good, you won't be afraid. Not that it's a prohibition to be afraid. Either way, according to the Rambam, that you have to work on your courage, this person in battle, not to be afraid. And what's the way to do this? What does the Rambam say? The way to do this is by putting your faith in Hashem. Forgetting about, right, again, transcending the self. Forgetting about your own problems. Forgetting about your own family, even. And just focus on the war that's in front of you. Parenthetically, Rabbeinu Yonah in Shari Tshuva actually expands this idea to include any pain or suffering that someone's confronted with throughout life, not just a military battle. He says that if you're confronted with something that's fearful, you should put your faith in Hashem and don't be afraid. So he doesn't just limit it to battle, he expands that, but that would be relevant to the first part, the moral and psychological courage, but we're not going to deal with that now. We're going to focus on the military aspect. So another important caveat about this Rambam is the Rambam's not telling us when we should go to war. Right? He's not addressing that here. He's assuming that there's a good reason that we should be at war, and someone who's in that war needs to not be afraid. But he's not saying that we should go and be courageous and go out and make wars. Right? That's not what he's saying. So what really needs to be addressed is, so at what point do we now say there are rules of when you're allowed to go to war? The Rambam has a lot of halachos based in the Gemara of when that would be allowed, But again, he's not addressing that here. It's once you're in war, you must be courageous. But how do I decide when to go to war? Are there any times where perhaps I'm too courageous and I go to battle even though I shouldn't be going to battle? So the following pasuk is an important pasuk from Mishlei, the next source, which the way the Gemara understands the pasuk is relevant to part one, the moral and psychological aspect. But that's not, again, we're not dealing with that now. We're focusing on the perspective of the military, the physical courage. And for that we have to go to the Ralbam, who's a 14th century Jewish philosopher, has a commentary on the Chumash. And let's see how he, and Tanakh, let's see how he understands this pasuk. So again, source number 9. Source number 9. The pasuk in Mishlei says, Ashrei Adam Mefache Tamim. Praiseworthy is someone who is always afraid. So again, we have to, if we were dealing with this in terms of the psychological and moral aspect of courage and fear, we would be dealing with this in the first part. But now let's put that aside. Ashrei adam mefachei tamid. Praiseworthy is the one who is fearful. Umaksha libo, but if you harden your heart, yipo bera, it'll cause evil. It'll cause damages. So what exactly does this mean? So look in source number 10. This is just in English, no Hebrew here, but I'll translate. The Rabbag understands. Ashrei adam mefachei tamid. So lemisha ra'oi lefached mimeni. So you should be afraid of something that's worthy of being afraid of. Kizes siva. If there is something that is warranted, that you have a fear of this, the Rabbag says, you should be afraid of that. And to some extent, he says, don't try to overcome that fear. If there's something that warrants being, right, driving without your seatbelt, and this is sort of the bad, right, so I'm courageous, I'm driving without a seatbelt. No, you should be afraid of driving without your seatbelt. You shouldn't feel courageous to drive without your seatbelt. So, and he continues, V'ula, on the flip side, Mishu Makshalibo, someone who's stubborn, and if you're not afraid of something that you should be afraid of, it'll turn out to be bad for you. And now he gives two very important examples of someone, of people who were not afraid of something they should have been afraid of. They were too courageous. He says, hardening of the heart, hichriva beis hamikdash harishon vasheni, caused the destruction of both of the beis hamikdashes. Both beis hamikdashes were destroyed because of people who were too courageous. V'zeshim lo, and he gives an example. V'zeshim lo yat tzidkiyah maksha libo. If the king Tzidkiyah was not so stubborn, by amasin tzavar otachas ol malach babel, he should have just conformed and been subservient to the king of Babel. So if he would have conformed, lo galinu miartzenu, he wouldn't have been exiled. So Tzidkiyah was too courageous. He went to battle. He wasn't subservient, and that caused, according to Rabbag, the destruction of the first Beis Hamikdash. Abachena inyan bayis bay, the bayis bay is the second Beis Hamikdash as well. Lo hayu nichna'in l'malchus, they weren't subservient to the kingdoms that were around them. Acheres v'nosin tzavar and tachason, they should have just been subservient. So here the Rabbag introduces this concept of, yes, there could be people who are too courageous, who do things because they're not, and they don't feel the fear, and they'll do things that are actually destructive, and that caused the destruction of both first and second Beis Hamikdashes according to the Rabbag. So now, what we're going to do is to explore this idea of being too courageous as a debate between Rabbi Yossi HaGlili and Rabbi Akiva. We'll see how this debate of whether or not there is whether or not we are too courageous, or that could happen, is impactful to the historical factors surrounding them at that time, and that would be the Bar Kokhba rebellion. So we'll use Rabbi Binyamin Lau's book. That's the photocopy you have in front of you, The Sages, Volume 2, where he first presents the debate between these two sages, Rabbi Yossi HaGlili and Rabbi Akiva, and then in the source after that, he'll bring this debate into modern-day Israel, and then from there we'll go into see how this relates to Hanukkah. So now we are in source number 11. So Rabbi Binyamin Blau, I advise everybody to buy his books. They are great. There are three volumes where he goes through debates that the sages had and their relevance to the historical time period, And then he ties it into modern day, and that's exactly what he's going to do here. They're put out by Magid Books. They're not that expensive. You can get them on Amazon. It's written in English, and it's clear, as you will see. So here, source number 11. So the fearful and the faint-hearted, the dispute between Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Yossi Aglili concerning the selection of soldiers. Again, historical context here is the Bar Kokhba rebellion. So he says here, Bar Kokhba's first step as military leader was to recruit fighters. His recruitment method was both wondrous and worrisome. Wondrous to the young new recruits, and worrisome to the sages. So here's a quote from the Talmud Yerushalmi. Bar Koziva was there, and that's the same name as Bar Kokhba, and he had 200,000 troops who had cut off their little fingers. The sages sent word to him, "How long are you going to turn Israel into a maimed people?" He said to them, "How otherwise is it possible to test them?" They replied to him, "Anyone who cannot uproot a cedar of Lebanon while riding on his horse will not be registered in your army." So there were 200,000 who were qualified one way and another 200,000 who were qualified the other way. But you see that Bar Kokhba originally, the way you had to prove that you were worthy of being in his army is you had to cut off your little finger, your pinky. Okay, so that's pretty, that doesn't really happen nowadays, but that's what, you know, sort of barbaric, but that's what he did to prove their courage. Rabbi Lau continues, "Young men flocked to enlist in Bar Kokhba's army and were willing to undergo the brutal requirements to do so. Their first test was to cut off a finger to prove their fearlessness and high threshold for pain. The sages did not approve of the brutality with which Bar Kokhba selected his soldiers." The next source here that that's indented, this is this gets to the Machlokas Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Yossi Aglili. So indented. "And the officers shall speak further to the people, and they shall say, 'What man is there that is fearful and faint-hearted? Let him go and return to his house.'" So you should recognize this quote as the pasuk that we quoted originally. And so the pasuk that said, "You should go home if you're afraid." So how do you understand this? So Rabbi Akiva says, "Fearful and faint-hearted, what does it mean you're afraid?" It's meant literally. And this is what the Rambam was referring to before, that you take it at face value. Someone who is actually cannot endure the rigors of warfare and face a drawn sword. Rabbi Yossi Aglili says, no, fearful and faint-hearted means one who is afraid because of transgressions he has committed. Therefore, the Torah has placed him in the same category as others so that he might return on their account. So you have machlokas between Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Yossi Aglili. When it says you are afraid, what does that mean? Are you afraid because physically in the war you're afraid? Or are you afraid of your sins that might cause you to get harmed because Hashem's not really looking over you because of your sins? So who knows, right, who was the big proponent of Bar Kokhba? Which sage? Rabbi Akiva. So Rabbi Akiva is saying, who is fearful has to go home. Bar Kokhba, right, courageous, cut off your pinky. I'm not saying Rabbi Akiva said you have to cut off your pinky. But in that camp of fighting back, of being courageous, here is Rabbi Akiva. And you can continue reading on your own. There's some more that he brings, but he really brings out this point of the dispute between Rabbi Yossi Aglili and Rabbi Akiva, and its context in terms of, should we encourage Bar Kokhba's rebellion? Should we encourage Bar Kokhba's encouragement of courage? Or should we sort of take a step back and not promote a rebellion? Right? Or not encourage courage. Okay, so that's one important historical point. In source number, skip 12 and go to 13, we'll see how this really reverberates down to the modern day and age. So in a different chapter, Rabbi Lau shows how this is important to the state of Israel. Source number 13. Jewish historical memory combines five catastrophes into a single day of mourning, the ninth of Av. Listed among these catastrophes is the fall of Beitar, which signified the defeat of Bar Kokhba and the end of the revolt. 1,800 years later, the flames of this revolt were rekindled when at the Second Zionist Congress in 1898, Max Nordau called for a muscular Judaism, and the Bar Kokhba Club was founded in Berlin. The Zionist movement emphasized the historical connection between the Bar Kokhba revolt and the modern struggle for Jewish independence. It became customary to sing songs on Lag BaOmer that praised Bar Kokhba as a bold, independent fighter. Next paragraph. Zionist youth movements in the diaspora adopted Lag BaOmer as the national holiday of Jewish youth. In 1916, the World Zionist Organizations in Warsaw organized a mass camping trip in the forest for all the children in Zionist youth movement. Several of the movements designated Lag BaOmer as the day when new members were officially inaugurated. The bow and arrow, a symbol of the holiday, became the emblem of the Gadna, the pre-military training program for Israeli youth, which was founded in Jewish high schools under the British mandate on Lag BaOmer. The purpose of this organization was to prepare Jewish youth in the land of Israel for the work of national defense. The Palmach was founded on the same day, and on Lag BaOmer, the command was issued to establish the Israeli Defense Forces. Beitar became a symbol of the revisionist movement led by Zev Jabotinsky, as his song of Beitar attests, "From the pit of decay and dust, with blood and sweat, shall arise a race proud, generous, and cruel." Jabotinsky had no patience for compromise. He was convinced that the flames of the revolt, regardless of their consequences, would nourish the dawning nation. So you get the idea here, is that the Zionist movement, as it began, wanted to become more muscular. We were too much in the, you know, a ghetto Jew was weak. The Zionist movement wanted to prove that we can be strong, we can be courageous, we can have a military, and we can fight back. And they went to Bar Kokhba as their symbol, as their pride of someone who is Jewish, who revolted, who showed that we could be courageous. If you skip to the second side, and you could again read this on your own, it's pretty self-explanatory, but if you read on the second side, the last paragraph. In the early 1980s, now we fast forward. In the early 1980s, Yehoshaphat Harkavi published an article claiming that Bar Kokhba had led the Jewish people down a path of ruin, not redemption. Yisrael Eldad launched a vigorous counterattack, and a dispute ensued. Their polemic serves as one of the markers of both the collapse of national pride among secular Zionists, as well as the rise of theological Zionism among the religious right wing. Jabotinsky's Beitar legacy, sunk in political quagmire, lost its splendor, and few continued to invoke it proudly. But some wings of religious Zionism found themselves drawn to the Beitar vision. These nationalists rallied around the ethos of Beitar and consolidated their forces against their more conciliatory opponents. The cultural heroes of the nationalist camp were those who waved the flag of Beitar as guerrilla fighters of the underground and as poets of the resistance. And here are some important names. The spirit of the Bar Kokhba revolt is still alive in these quarters. Students of Rabbi Tzvi Yehuda Cook quote their teacher who defended Rabbi Akiva's identification of Bar Kokhba as the Messiah, son of Joseph. On the other hand, ultra-Orthodox Jews who do not take part in the Zionist project continue to hold fast to the model of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, who we have not seen, Rabbi Lau deals with previously in the book, as evidenced in a Hasidic pamphlet from the Beis Medrash of the Rezina Rebbe, and we don't have that quote here. You'll have to go and buy the book to see the rest of it. But the point is that here you have two camps. Do we focus on the Beitar, the fight, the revolt, the courage, the military, physical courage, or do we take a more, you know, pacifist, not necessarily with a negative sense? Right? Look what happened with Beitar. Everybody died. And Rabbi Lau points it out in some of the passages that we skipped. So do you want to be physically courage? Do you want to have that courage for the physical, for the military? Beitar, everyone died. The Rabbat says the first and second Beis HaMikdash were destroyed because people had too much courage when it came to the military. Or do you take a more passive view and not encourage military fighting? So this is a debate, and it is still a debate, and which side you and I, you know, might fall on is really up to each and every one of us to identify with, just to keep in mind that we're not in Israel and we're not the ones who are putting our lives on the line. This doesn't necessarily question Israel. It's not questioning Israel's ability to defend its country. Obviously, that's something that we need to have a military force. The question is how much of that should we encourage? How much of the brute force should we be encouraging? So what about Hanukkah? We spoke about Beitar, we spoke about Bar Kokhba, Lag BaOmer. What about Hanukkah? So if you go to source number 12, I think this debate really resonates with Hanukkah as well. Source number 12, you have to go back, on the top of that page. Source number 12 is the Gemara in Shabbos. The Gemara in Shabbos says, "My Hanukkah, what is Hanukkah? What's the holiday of Hanukkah remembering?" So the Tanna Rabbanan, the rabbis taught, the Chaf Hei B'Kislev, on the 25th day of Kislev, Yomei Hanukkah, Tamnaya Inun, there are 8 days of Hanukkah. We cannot fast. We cannot do a eulogy. So where does this come from? So when the Greeks, the Syrian Greeks, came in and defiled the temple, all the oils were defiled. When the Chashmonaim came and they won the battle, and they found one jug. It was pure. It had the seal of the Kohen Gadol on it. It wasn't defiled. There was just enough for one day. So there was a miracle that happened. And it lit for 8 days. The next year, they established it as a holiday. So it's very interesting that the Gemara, what are we celebrating with the miracle of Hanukkah?
Military victory.
So you say military victory. That's not really what the Gemara says. I'm not saying you're wrong, but that's not what the Gemara says. The Gemara it does acknowledge a military victory, but it acknowledges it within the context of the lighting of the menorah. It's sort of a side point, right? There was everything was defiled. Happened to be, when the Chashmonaim won, we were able to find this one jug and it lit for 8 days. That's the miracle of Hanukkah. It acknowledges the military defeat, but it's definitely not emphasizing the military defeat. You have this, I gave a shiur, I think it was my first shiur at Kingsway. It was the Lox and Learn, my first year as an intern, was why the sages left out Hanukkah from the Talmud. If you go through the Gemara, this is a Gemara, so this is basically it. There's a few pages, a few stories, a few laws about Hanukkah throughout the sea of the Talmud. It's a little bit. Purim has its own tractate. Pesachim has its own tractate. All the holidays really get a whole big coverage, but Hanukkah gets nothing. So that year I addressed why that is. And part of the reason, or at least one of the reasons, is because we, throughout the ages, have really de-emphasized this idea of the Chashmonaim revolt, of rebelling. And this physical courage is something that the sages and the rabbinic figures throughout the ages have not really encouraged that much. Our emphasis has been on more of the spiritual part of the miracle of Hanukkah, which is the lighting of the menorah. That's not to say there was no military victory, and that's not something that we're celebrating, but the focus in terms of the rabbinic side of it has been more on the spiritual aspects of Hanukkah, not the physical aspects. This comes up also when Professor Mark Shapiro was here last week, addressed this when it came to the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. He mentioned that Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg was one of the few rabbinic figures who actually praised the Ghetto Uprising as something positive. Many rabbinic figures didn't look at it as a positive thing, this physical courage to fight back, to rebel. And it all goes back to these debates. Is Bar Kokhba rebellion? Is it a good thing? Rabbi Akiva takes one side. All the other sages take the other side. Is Hanukkah, the rebellion, a good thing? So obviously there are positive benefits for it. But is something, are we going to encourage it outright? So it seems like the sages, for the most part, have not, sort of emphasized it. And now in modern-day Israel, besides for Lag BaOmer being, this Bar Kokhba, so the Maccabees are a big symbol as well. Right? The Tel Aviv Maccabees are the basketball team. For secular Zionists, the Maccabees are a symbol of physical power, of fighting back. So on the one hand, we have that there has been an acknowledgement that physical courage, according to at least the Zionists, have taken on that as their symbol, but the rabbinic works have not done that as much. I think for us, we're sort of in the middle somewhere. And you will find rabbis who say this. I'm not saying that nobody says this. Is that on the one hand, you will not emphasize physical military rebellion that much, but on the other hand, acknowledge that it's important and it has its role. And that the miracle of Hanukkah is really a balance between the physical aspects of the war and the spiritual aspects of the fact that the candles did light for 8 days. So there's a physical, a military courage, as well as this spiritual idea as well. And we're sort of balancing both of these aspects. We don't want to promote too much fighting, because over the years, I think it hasn't really led to that, proactive fighting has not really led to that many great consequences. So again, we have to sort of balance these things. But this is all really on a philosophical and theoretical level. Here in the U.S., most of us are not in the army. I assume. Anybody here in the Army? So most of us have not really had the opportunity, maybe, who were in the Army, right? So we have people who are veterans, but most of us are not, and even those who are at this stage of their lives, aren't really facing this physical military courage battle and this debate. But we do have is really the part one of this year, this physical, this moral and psychological courage. And perhaps in honor of Hanukkah, again, it's not really the message of Hanukkah, perhaps is the promotion of some sort of physical courage, a military courage, but since that's not really relevant to us, and it's somewhat of a big debate, so we can do the less problematic, the less debated aspect of courage, and pick one thing, whether it's a moral thing or a psychological thing, that in honor of Hanukkah we'll confront it, and we will either try to decrease the fear that we have of that thing, or we will try to figure out the ways, like we suggested in the first half of this year, to increase our ability, our capacity to act. So there's one thing that we could gain, to have the courage for, to become more moral people, to become more religious people. Everybody has their own examples. I'm not going to give, I gave some for me, but everybody has their own examples, and you should all reflect on that. Take a few minutes over the course of the next few weeks to figure out what is it that we can work on, how we can build and boost our courage. That is all.
Thank you.
I will take questions if anybody has questions. I know some people are trying to run out, but anything. Yeah.
The argument about the rebellions against Babylonia or against Rome.
Right.
Was the person, I forget the rabbi who was saying, you shouldn't have done it.
Right.
Was he saying, you shouldn't have done it in this particular instance against these superpowers?
Right, that's why it's not a simple question. That's why it's a tension. In those scenarios, actually a good question, I didn't address this. In those scenarios, there were other factors involved. The prophets, for the first temple, the prophets were telling them not to go to battle, and they sort of ignored that. So there they had the prophecy aspect, and they went against that.
Right.
For the second base, I make this, there were no prophecies. There was more of just a question of leadership, what you're going to end up doing, and he's saying in that point, according to him, they made the wrong decision. Whether or not that means that, nowadays if we decide this to do X, Y, or Z, that's the right or wrong decision, it's hard. And that's really what the struggle is, and that's where I think the leaders really aren't sure, because on the one hand, the history has shown that these rebellions have not worked out. So far we mentioned four. So Hanukkah worked. The other three didn't. So is it worth it to put our lives on the line for something that we're not sure is the right thing to do? So that takes courage. And the question is, and really the balance is that courage a warranted courage, or is that too courageous? Is that going too far? Is it not, the acceptable risks that we should be taking? Anything else? Okay. Thank you all for coming. And so much.